name is Jada Cesar, mental health and body positive advocate.
I'm Louise Troen, the Vice President of International Marketing and Communications at Bumble.
And welcome to the first episode of Unsubscribe. This is the podcast that aims to empower us to unsubscribe from the negativity and resubscribe to patterns of behaviour that help us all be the best versions of ourselves.
The first woman to join us today is the inspirational Vanessa Kingori, and we're thrilled to have her on our sofa.
Vanessa Kingori, publishing director of British Vogue, is the first black female to ever be in this role. Since being appointed in 2017, she has made momentous changes. We're so excited to gain insight into where her resilience, ambition, and this relentless drive comes from.
As a mother-to-be, a leader in the office, and a trailblazer in attitude, Vanessa has challenged adversity and overcome stereotypical expectations of what it means to be a woman in business. From meeting Oprah to being awarded an MBE, her outlook is an inspiration to us, and we're sure it will be for you too. Let's get started.
When I first found out I was pregnant, I was literally like, oh my God, this is terrible timing. You know, I was like in panic, and I happened to bump into an old colleague who's much older, I mean in 70s. I was just like, this is terrible timing, you should wait at least 5 years. And I'm like, I've been with the company for 10 years, like, do you know what I mean? And and then actually as I got into it, I was like, no, because I've got this, it's fine, you know, I know how to, well, I don't know exactly how to do it all, but I know I can figure it out, do you know what I mean?
But I also think, like, the very nature of strong, driven, ambitious women is that there will never be a right time to have to reprioritize your daily life because you have a child and you need to bring them up, and that focus changes. There's never going to be a right.
There's always a million and one things going on.
You know? But also, that's the nature of us as people, is if there wasn't, we would just create a million and one things to do.
Yeah.
Because that's the kind of...
Yeah, it's true. The space is always full. Like, my boyfriend's just like, I'm really tired of you saying, when things quieten down. He's like, when will that be?
They're never going to quieten down. No, because there's always another fashion week around the corner.
It's like the saying, like, when are you going to, you know, my grandparents, when are you going to settle down? I'm like, when we're settling on anything,
it's so true.
The right thing to do.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I question them, they're like, oh, yes, that's a valid
question. Actually such a terrible term, isn't it? When are you going to give your life away?
Yeah, when are you going to simmer down and be quiet? Never.
And sorry, but if you do that in your mid 30s, 40s, and then what, you've got the rest, like the other half of your life to live in this stagnated place of like, we work towards marriage and relationship to settle down, and then what do we do after that? That frightens me to my core. I don't even think I don't know, my idea of my perception around relationships and partnerships has really changed lately, and I think I just want a life partner that I can do life well with and not necessarily wait for somebody that wants to get married.
It's really funny, like everybody keeps saying to me and my partner, you know, well, when are you going to marry her? Why haven't you proposed? Why aren't you guys going to get married? And he's like, I've tried. She's not interested.
I'm trying.
That diamond is not a measure of
I'm
your
love. I'm just like, I just want to be with someone who wants to be on the journey and is there. And I don't, you know, I leave myself the sort of... right to change my mind on this. You know, I don't know how having a child will change things, but I don't necessarily want a contract, you know, with someone to say, and this is a very personal view, I love a wedding, I'm all up for it, you know, to other people's, but it is this sort of strange thing, and this sometimes from really empowered women, this strange assumption that everything that you want as a woman, you know, every woman wants to be married, and that's the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is to be a wife and a mother. And if you're not yet, it's because someone else is holding you back from it. It's not that you may have decided that that's not the route that you want. Or then if you don't want that, then you're, you know, somehow this hard-nosed person and da-da-da. It's like, I want to have, you know, and I do have, I'm really lucky, a great life partner, monogamous, brilliant life partner, but I don't necessarily need the fairy tale that's been outlined for me. So
I love that though, because that's exactly why we're doing this, is to say to people that this kind of tapestry that's been built in terms of expectations of goals and happiness doesn't need to be stitched that way forever. And as our influences change and culture changes and society evolves, we can restitch it in a way that makes sense for us now. And the rules and regulations that were built years ago, they're not relevant now. And the things that people thought made them happy 50 years ago are very different of so many different variables like social media and digital technology and all that stuff. And I think, you know, I'm 32 this year and I'm single. And so many times people say, you know, are you all right? And I'm like, I'm great. And and this is a choice because I'm focusing on my career.
Yeah.
But people always approach me with a kind of sentiment of sadness of like, poor you, you know. Are you okay with this? It's like, well, first, I don't really have a choice, so I have to be. And secondly, you know, everyone's time comes when it's appropriate and ready.
Yeah. And I'd say you probably do have a choice, but you've made a choice to focus on other things right now, you know. And it is really true that just how binding those ideas, even if you think you're not buying into them, but those, you know, kind of, I guess, societal norms, how strangling they can be, you know.
But and also that's the purest form of conditioning. It's where you subconsciously or sort of ignorantly follow a pattern of expectations. And actually, like, you know, what we really want for our daughters and young women is to go, you don't need to follow the rules. Challenge the status quo.
Absolutely.
And stand up and ask, why do I have to be married by 30? Yeah. Why do I have to have kids by 35?
I was actually talking to a male friend of mine who said, I don't want to get married, he said. And he was like, I'd rather be in a relationship where I'm devoted to that person rather than committed. And a lot of my friends said, but isn't that the same thing? And I was like, actually, no.
Devotion, I really love that. I'm going to take that. Yes. That basically describes my sentiment as well.
Yeah, I want you to be here because because you want to be here, not because you have an obligation or a contract that ties you in here.
Yeah,
that's amazing. That scares people, though. I think that's the problem, is people feel unstable in that.
I am literally the runaway bride. I've been engaged 3 times. I've pulled off all 3. And I didn't know at the time that what was driving me was I didn't want to wake up one day and realize that the person next to me was there because of obligation, you know, and also that probably being Catholic and thinking, oh, I probably should get married, and this person's like, you know, quite nice, we've had quite a nice time, okay, yes, and then down the line being like, something in my gut is telling me I don't, you know, this isn't right for me, this isn't and I could not articulate for a really long time. I remember with my last fiance, everyone just, he was perfect. He was absolutely perfect on paper. All of my friends loved him. He had a great career, blah, blah, blah. And I couldn't articulate what it was that, why I didn't go through with, you know, the wedding and everything. And it was such a huge problem for everyone. I had such a huge falling out with, at the time, one of my closest friends, who basically was just like, you know, you just do not understand what love is. You know, you're so lucky to have this person. He's so good to you. And we broke up on really good terms. I just realized I did not want to get married. But it was so difficult for myself and for other people to just accept that, because you know, as a woman, you once you're asked by someone decent, you should go with it.
But I think this is the sad thing, that we're lucky to have somebody that treats us well, whereas that should be, that's the minimum.
Yeah.
You know, that that's respect and that love is just, that's expected. And it's those narratives that were fed in fairy tales, in rom-coms, that we're waiting to be saved. And actually, when somebody like yourself has things going on, has it together, we just need the cherry that's like, or even a dessert that can sit side by side with my great you know.
I always think that, like, for me personally, and we've talked a bit about this before, a lot of people have said to me, you know, you need to compromise. And, you know, maybe you're just looking for this extra special person that's funny and good looking and charismatic and good at their job, and that person doesn't
exist.
How
dare you?
Yeah, how dare I? Shut up, Louise. Go home. But the fact is that, like, I really believe that there are some things that are negotiable and some things that aren't negotiable. And the things that are not are things like humour, honesty, drive. It's not necessarily about, making lots of money or being really senior in a company, but it's the character traits in themselves that are non-negotiable for me. And then the things that can be negotiated, of course, are like, you know, what industry you work in or whether you get on with your parents, all those sorts of things. And I think everyone individually has their own set of what those pieces are. And I think it's really important to stay true to them because they're your foundations of what ultimately will make you happy in that relationship.
You know, it's like I know so many people who have, you know, the dream and are miserable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, it looks great to everyone outside because they've ticked all of the societal boxes and, you know, they're married and they look after themselves and they might have a couple of kids and they've got a nice enough job. But life is really short. And if you're not doing things that sort of, you know, really set your heart alight, then what is the point? You'll be miserable anyway.
I love that.
You know, so it's just really interesting. It's kind of, I think, really have to take time and look at who is happy, I think, as well. Truly happy, not projecting. And we can all get a sense of when people are sort of giving you the happy vibes, but you're like, it's a little bit sad behind the eyes. And I think it's really important to like learn from that. I spent a lot of time looking at who around me was really happy and what I thought and asking them what made them happy, you know. And they were not always the most obvious people. They were not the people who had the most necessarily, although some people who have lots are, funnily enough, really happy. But not always, you know. Sometimes it's just the people who've done the stuff that they want to do and they're with the person they want to be with, or they're not with anyone because they're tired of being with the wrong person, you know, whatever. So I think there's sort of a formula out there that works for everyone, but it's not the same formula, and that's what society has wrong. We're being told that if we all do pretty much the same kind of thing, we'll be fine, but it's just not right. It doesn't make sense. Nothing else is kind of one size fits all in life. So,
and where do you get your sense of clarity of what feels right to you? You've got your head, your heart, your gut, but what is it that you tune into when you're thinking, okay, this is what I want to do, this is what I feel is going to set my heart on fire, like you just said?
It's really funny, like I've always had this really strong instinct, and it was, I didn't really understand what it was when I was younger. And I just always remember my family, in particular my sister and friends, just being like, oh my gosh, you've got such an amazing instinct. And for ages, I sort of didn't really get what that was, and I went against it. So you'd get a vibe about something or someone, and either just like, we say, like in the Caribbean, my spirit takes to it, you know, it's like, and you can't really fully explain why, or equally just not everything feeling like looking right on paper, but just not having the feeling of like, this is right. And that's with jobs, with people, you know, all of it. And I think as I've got older, I've just learned to trust my instincts a lot more. And to go with, even when it seems irrational, you know, I've definitely turned down opportunities or stepped aside from opportunities and from people based on nothing rational, nothing I could put on paper. But every time I've been proven to be right, and when I've gone against that, it's been like slightly to my peril. You know, sometimes you're just like, I'm just being weird about this. Let me just go with it. You know, and then you're just kind of like, this is going Pete Tong and I don't really know why. So I just think instinct is really, really important to me. And I think we all have an instinct which we either choose to really tune into or choose to kind of override with being sensible.
Yeah,
so I remember, choose not to be sensible.
I think Oprah, that's a great tip, but I think Oprah also said something like, you'll get a sign, whether it's in your stomach when it churns, or in your chest when you get that tight chest panting feeling, or it's going to hit you in the face. And if you don't listen to that sign, it's going to become more and more obvious. And she was referencing abusive relationships. And she said, to a point where it actually will physically do something to you. So listen to it from the start. But I'm wondering, is there people that maybe you modeled this from growing up in your family? What was that set up like?
I think definitely my mother. I'm really lucky to have a really sort of strong, quite matriarchal family. And my mother is just one of those people that just does what she feels is right, irrespective of what anyone else is saying. So, you know, my mum got married when she was now, I think, relatively young, in her very early 20s, had two children straight away. My father's Kenyan. She moved to Kenya, had this amazing sort of whirlwind, exciting, but all of her family was saying, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. You know, who do you know there? What support will you have? All of those things.
And where was your mum from?
My mum's from St. Kitts in the Caribbean, but she was living here in London. My mother and father met in London. And, you know, she just kind of did it anyway. And she left behind a lot of dreams that she was nurturing here. And you can completely see why, you know, her family was sort of going, this is bonkers. What are you going to do? And she just kind of went with it, learned a different language, learned, you know, to cook different food, created all these amazing experiences for herself. And she sort of lives with no regret. And what's really interesting is, even though my mother and father got divorced, and there were lots of I told you so, she never regretted that. She never, you know, for her, that marriage had served a lot of purposes that were not maybe, and, you know, and she's just lived her life like that throughout, always slightly taking what seem like odd decisions. But she's very, very strong-willed and strong in her mind. And I think that, yeah, I think I've definitely learned that from her. And I'm really grateful to her for that, you know. I'm really, really grateful, yeah.
I also think that if, when you're told to do something and it doesn't pan out well, then you almost want to blame someone else. Whereas if it doesn't pan out well and you just decided to do it,
it's all
the onus is on yourself. Yeah. So I can live with that,
yeah,
because it's a lesson learned. But I don't want to ever be dictated and told to do something that I'm not sure of.
I also feel like we should be encouraging young people, or everyone, to take more risks and to really question what's in front of you. I was listening to another podcast recently on kind of the notion of being remarkable in business, and most remarkable leaders, they challenge the end of what usually is the decision. So they go one step further and say, no, we're going to blow that campaign up in six more markets, or do you know what, we're going to throw another 100 grand into this even though we don't have it, and we'll figure it out. And it's the big decisions that most people in the room are disagreeing with that actually 9 times out of 10 reset and recalibrate the kind of perspective of that work. And I feel like we have to encourage young people to keep asking, like, why
we
is that rule in
challenges,
place?
Right? It's like, you know, if we all just live really safe lives, it's like, then how is that living? And, you know, it's also that notion in success about, you know, failure, quote unquote, is part of success. And you don't, because it's part, the amazing learning experiences. And if you don't do things based on your gut, even though they might seem nuts, you know, then you don't open yourself up to learning experiences. If you always take the safe choice, and I'm not sort of like advocating just doing nuts things just cause, but it's like, if you really feel strongly and guided to do something, then do it, and don't feel badly if it doesn't pan out in the long run, because the experience itself is, you know, is of value. It's not always just about the perfect end result, because end results are kind of cumulative. You know, there's accumulation of experiences and ideas and thought that lead to a good end result, right? So to your point about, you know, the kind of CEO or what have you, they might not get the end result that they've thrown out in that meeting, but what they're doing is stretching everyone to get beyond, you know, the kind of barrier that they're at. And that's what kind of life is as well. You know, you have to kind of throw it further than your comfort zone in order to get to the good stuff, you know.
100%
So, yeah.
What's the biggest risk you're glad you took in life and in business?
Yeah, gosh, it's a really good question. I feel like I'm taking risks all of the time. Definitely, it sounds really odd to say it, but going to Vogue, because when, so my career trajectory, I was publisher of GQ. It was all going great guns. I had lots of firsts there. You know, I was the first woman to be publisher there, but it was the first person of colour. And I felt like there were lots of people who underestimated me. And I was able to really deliver in that role and knock it out the park with the numbers that really speak for themselves and so on. And it was all going great guns. And I sort of thought, just kind of probably quit while you're ahead here. Do you know what I mean? Don't push it, you know. And I was at the point where I sort of thought I would probably quite like a completely different challenge now. And the opportunity for sort of to move to Vogue came along. And again, it was lots of firsts and so on. Part of me just felt like it was risky because there was more to lose. You know, I kind of was on this winning streak and, you know, I could probably slightly mess up my legacy if I went to Vogue and failed. It's big and it's exposed. And I also really was at the point where I wanted to affect change beyond doing a great job, you know. And my job's really about delivering numbers. I really, of course, I sort of by that point knew I could do that. It would take a lot of hard work, but it was also about just feeling like that there was just something more that I wanted to be a part of something which was kind of meaningful and more enriching. And, you know, so Edward Enningful, our editor, of course, was very vocal about his aspirations and injecting a lot of diversity into Vogue, changing the conversation with women. And of course, we really connected on that and built this amazing partnership. And it felt scary because it just felt, now it feels like really natural. Everybody's like, oh, it's great that you're talking about body image and it's fabulous you're talking about diversity and all of these things. And everybody's been really embracing of it. But at the time when we were talking about it, we had a lot of pushback with people saying, this is not the content that people want from Vogue. And, you know, these kinds of cover stars don't sell. And this kind of messaging, you know, people come to Vogue to escape. They don't want to hear about, you know, mental health issues and, you know, all of those sorts of things. And it felt like I could really sort of mess up a good streak. You know, I know that sounds really counterintuitive because it's like, you're offered a great job on Vogue, go and take it, you know, off you go. But I definitely felt like it was kind of risky for me. Like the chance, the stakes were higher and then therefore the chance of failure was a lot more.
I feel like the exposing point is like really valid here because, you know, when you are doing interviews on behalf of an institution, really, and, you know, Vogue is more than just a magazine, it is a movement in itself and it's a representation of so much more, and being a figurehead for that institution and expected to deliver on that in interviews and you know that is challenging on a personal level, I'm imagining, as well as a professional.
And it's that thing where everyone's watching, because you're so right, with Vogue it's like everybody feels that they have a stake in it because everyone, it's so interesting, no matter where you go in the world, everyone has a touch point or some sort of experience. Either they remember the first copy that they saw or a cover image that struck them or their mother reading it or they've collected copies forever. So what it means is that nobody comes to, particularly women actually, but more broadly, nobody comes to a conversation about changing Vogue without feeling, having a personal view on it. So you're kind of messing with something that you know, people have strong opinions on, and therefore there's a high level of judgment that comes with that. So you know, it's sort of, but it's one of those things where you look back on it now and I think, well, wasn't that much of a risk. But at the time, yeah. visceral kind of, you know, it was, yeah. yeah, I felt sort of, you know, the sort of blocks looming above my head kind of thing.
But do you feel like your instinct really guided you in those initial
definitely.
Months?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, exactly. Because I'm really sort of about people. So the brand itself is great, but it wouldn't have been enough for me without connecting with Edward. We already knew each other, but having conversations with him about what his aspirations were, what mine were, and just feeling like, oh God, we are just like so aligned, and just instinctively I know that we can create a shift together. And I definitely know that he is someone who can leverage so much, and I can help to power him with that. And I didn't really know how, to be honest. It just was just that instinct of like, yes, this is amazing. And also just that kind of thing of like, I do quite like a challenge, you know. And there was a lot to do with the business of Vogue that needed a lot of changing. There was not a template in our company around what that change should look like, around digital transformation. I mean, to a large extent, I was sort of being asked to set it, you know. And so there, that's an instinctive thing as well. It's like, well, who am I going to learn this from? No, you just have to figure it out. You have to...
Pave your own path.
Exactly. And so there was a lot of that, which was just like, okay, I'm going to figure this out and try and knock it out of the park.
What was the kind of first conversation of channeling that change? Do you remember it? And what did it feel like if you do?
You mean making it happen or starting to...
making it happen. Maybe having to like express the new idea to, I don't know, a board member or something like that.
I think that, to be honest, Edward had done a lot of it already, and he was really great. He'd come over from New York, and he was great about sharing his plan with me. And I sort of just plugged into a lot of that. But I remember things like going to our cover meetings, you know, and, you know, just seeing at the time that people were sort of saying with their mouths, this is great, but with their eyes thinking, I'm just a bit worried, I'm nervous, we haven't gone down this path, but just feeling so confident in, you know, what we were doing and the choices we were making and the messages that we were sending out, that we could kind of, you know, we could take it if it didn't. You know that thing of like, even if everyone else doesn't get it, I really feel like we've done the right thing. You know, so there's just that kind of feeling of, we've called it right here. Maybe everyone's not going to be there yet, but
I feel like that's the same with lots of decisions in life. As long as you are morally and principally moving things forward in the right way, then no one can really question that directive.
Exactly.
I think that conviction is also, it's unwaverable. Being able to stand forth and say, like, this is what I believe in, and not everyone's going to agree. And if you're consistent with that tread of thought, then I think change happens. With that.
Definitely. And change is one of those things which, you know, I always say this as inside my organization and whenever I'm speaking publicly, we are not conditioned as human beings to like change. And anyone who says, you know, that they love it and they really, they're not being wholly true. Like, what happens is some of us know that there is a necessity for change and we're open to it, but it's an uncomfortable state for everyone. And to, I think, affect good and positive change, you have to have a strength of conviction, because the majority of people you're dealing with will be knowingly or unknowingly pulling against it, because it's uncomfortable. It's really uncomfortable. And to inherit a business which had been run in one way for a quarter of a century and try to have those people who'd worked in that way for that length of time work differently, think differently, place value on different things is something that everyone can say, objectively, I totally get that, that makes sense. But they're doing it is really hard.
Yeah.
And there are times where you can really feel like, you know, like you're pulling against the grain a little bit. A bit kind of unkind, because you can see people in their discomfort. And, you know, the other human response is that you want for people, you want to make people comfortable. You want for, but if you really want to make change, you have to guide people through their discomfort, live through it. You have to be the strong pillar, you know, that is sticking to that conviction and doesn't actually give that sort of area of get out, you know, just to get to the comfortable space again. So yeah, it's kind of like just quite an interesting, I'm really, really proud of the year that we had last year. And, you know, obviously this year is just about upping the stakes, do it again and have a baby. Yeah.
Just keep killing it. Just keep pushing. The bar gets higher and higher and higher.
Where does it stop? It doesn't.
It doesn't.
Throw in an extra challenge.
I know. I know. And it's quite hard because we often do that. I know I do that in my career and same with Louise. But then it's like, actually, just got to slow down.
Yeah, and also just take a minute to be grateful. Like,
yeah.
We're all doing brilliant work and are around great people all day, every day. And that gratitude, I think, is really humbling. And if you forget it and you don't pay your respects to it, life will just pass in a flash and you forget to kind of have perspective on the small things that actually add value.
Oh, it's so true. Like, when you've got daily challenges, it's really easy to kind of forget that overall you're in a really positive position. And it is so true, just take a minute.
I heard you speak about this concept notion even of work-life blend, which I love. And I've been using it like 7 times today, so I've completely stolen it from you. And it's this idea that, you know, work-life balance, everyone kind of pushes and struggles for it, but actually if you can find a career or a way of making money that is really adding value and making you happy, then this blend is so much more progressive. And I wondered if you could just kind of explain a bit about where that came from.
Well, I think like work-life balance is kind of a lie that we've been sold that's completely unachievable. If you just look at the pure maths, you know, we work technically 5 days a week and we have 2 days rest. Like, that's not balanced, you know. It's like you can't, those sums don't add up. And I think for women like us, you know, especially who are striving for to achieve new things and build careers and so on, it is undeniable that you have to invest a lot in that. And somehow, I think particularly women are made to feel a bit guilty about that. You're asked to aspire to it, but then when you do it, something has to give, you know. And I think kind of just accepting that a bit is okay. Like, accepting that in this moment, I'm going to give a little bit more to my work life than to my personal life. But the thing for me is not for too long. And if you're going to borrow time for work from your personal life, what are you going to borrow from your work life to balance out your personal life, you know, or to blend? So this is why I always say to people, it's just so vitally important to do something that you love, just because then you will be personally fulfilled, you know, in your work as well. And it's, I just think, you know, if you've got one great friend at work, like, really nurture that relationship. If you have to travel for work and you can take your partner or a friend or your kids, do it. You know, don't hold back from that, because actually our work lives owe a lot to our personal lives, and we shouldn't feel badly about it. It's the only way that you'll get to get that sort of personal fulfillment, because the time is not going to create itself. It will not. Work will just keep eating and eating and eating into that time. So
it's funny though, because we're personally striving to be successful,
yes,
and yet on that journey we're like, oh, I need to claw some of that balance back, but the very nature of what we're trying to do is personal and like life fulfilling anyway. It's not, you can't separate the two, especially when energy and emotion and feeling goes into it every day.
I think you can separate the two if you do a job that's just about paying the bills, you know. But I think if you're sort of pushing for more, then you have to kind of blend it in, and it becomes easier anyway. You know, when you do have those long hours or those challenging moments, if you kind of have love invested in what you do, it's you know, it's all in there. So I think it's just about, yeah, definitely trying to kind of merge the two in a healthy way. And this whole notion of balance is just, it's another thing that's kind of sent to drive us a little bit mad. You know, that I feel the same about kind of the sort of sexual revolution and the notion of women in work in particular, the whole idea of the kind of, you know, sexual revolution of women and women going out into the workforce was that, you know, we would could go out and be equals in the workplace and at the same time run great households. And that's not to say that that isn't possible, but it's expecting two lots of 100%. Like, how many women do you know who feel when they're nailing it at work, their life at home is not what has been prescribed to them? What's what we've all, or certainly our mothers, I think, and lots of us still have subscribed to, is that you'd be have an amazing home with great interiors, a great partner, and you look after the homestead for the most part. And if your partner does, you know, even sort of 20% of it, you're really acing things. So you have 100 to 80% of home life to take care of. And that's even before kids are involved, where women are still seen predominantly as primary carers. You know, to be a mother is a whole job. And to be a great mother, you have to be present at everything and, you know, at the cookie sales or whatever and, you know, at every play. But you also have to be at work and never use the excuse of your home life and be at every meeting and, you know, all of those things. Well, how can you be two lots of 100%, you know? So it's like we've been sold this lie by that, you know. The question of women's equality really is intrinsically linked to how men's role in society also shifts. And up until now, all that we've talked about is how women will change. Well, that doesn't make sense because someone has to pick up the slack somewhere else. Yeah. So we need much broader conversations. But this whole idea of balancing work and life and, you know, the homestead and workstead and being 100% in both areas is just bad math.
I mean, also the fact that we've pushed the conversation around feminism so far, but yet masculinity isn't really something we're talking about until, I'd say, up until this year, to be honest. Like, toxic masculinity, the just devastating rates of male suicide. So all of these things need to be said. And I think, personally, it's women that are probably going to start moving that conversation forward a little bit.
Oh, gosh, yeah, definitely.
We're often assumed, because we're a female-first, you know, empowerment social network, and everyone, you know, just assumes that all the kind of work we do is just for women. And actually, so much of our job as a business and a brand is to have a duty to re-educate men as well on appropriate methods and behavioural patterns in terms of when they connect or when they interact with women. And I actually think that there's a lot of work to do to help men. You know, there's this kind of dialogue at the moment about this toxic masculinity and how aggressive men are kind of intrinsically. And I actually don't personally necessarily agree with that. I think, you know, we do need to take a step back and say, where are those influences coming from? And how can we re-educate on what is a healthy interaction where both people are seen as people as opposed to a specific gender?
I think this is just absolutely amazing. And it's like, basically, what Bumble are doing is so incredibly important because it fits the lives that we're living now, you know, and there is no point also empowering women to, you know, I think your slogan is ask first and all of those things, if one half of society isn't ready to receive it, you know. And I think one of the challenges of feminism is that it very often is preaching to the choir. Of course, we all want more rights and we want to be acknowledged more and so on. But you can't change society by only speaking to half of it.
Yeah.
You have to engage. Men have to be engaged in the conversation. And I think their strengths have to be celebrated as well. And equally, their challenges need to be kind of worked on. And women can't move forward truly until men do as well. And so I think there's this new frontier, which is about addressing the challenges that, that men are having now around mental health, around what is their role in society. If women are going out and being breadwinners and earning the money and, you know, they're asking, you know, making the first move and asking men out on dates, and but they're also nailing it at home and they've got that covered, then what is the role of a man now? And for me, it's a pretty clear conundrum, but it, the conversation is not being had and we're not normalizing a kind of new approach from men, I think, at the moment. So
it's not black and white, it's and both. They can have it all and do what we do too. I believe, and I know that in the fashion world it's predominantly women, but how do men fit into that space? And how do we also, you're obviously a very conscious senior role model, how do we manage people's egos in that space and also be present with our own? Because I think, you know, it's easy to kind of work your way up and then slowly start becoming detached from what's really happening on the ground.
Yeah.
And how do we deal with
that? That detachment's something I think about all the time because, you know, I got into my industry because I really love, like, I'm a gregarious person. I love connections. I love being around people. And what you find is the kind of more senior you become in basically a corporate structure, the more you spend time on your own. It's a lot of planning and strategy, and it, you sort of sometimes are like, this isn't what I was doing this for, you know? So I have to kind of make really concerted efforts to get out of my office and spend time with people, either kind of, and not in a in a way that feels kind of forced, you know? Go out and sit on the edge of someone's desk and have a chat about something, or, you know, I'm really big on orchestrating time out, like nights out, lunches and so on with my team, because that's where the good stuff comes out. That's where you really, like, learn what people's kind of drive is and what their skill sets are beyond what, you know, what they present in the office. So, yeah, that's something I think about a lot. In terms of, you know, what's really interesting about the fashion industry is there are lots of women in it, but it's not driven by women, you know.
That's interesting.
And definitely on the business side, the power figures are still not entirely, but predominantly male. And definitely in legacy companies, there is a lot to work through. And I think that there's a lot going on at the moment that's kind of showing itself to be problematic. You know, if you look at a lot of the fashion houses, some of the challenges they're having with communications and so on at the moment, it's like the disconnect between sometimes who our audiences are and who is really pulling strings and making the decisions is starting to show in certain organisations. I think it's probably a really good thing.
Yeah, I agree. Throwing it out there, who were your heroes growing up?
Oh, gosh. Growing up, my...
Now, if you still have them.
I feel like they're really kind of basic.
No. I hope Oprah's
please
on
say
that
your
list.
Mum. Your mum and Oprah.
Basically, yeah. That's what I mean, like, really
okay, we're
basic.
Done.
Definitely Oprah. Because, but I know that's a really strange thing. Everyone thinks that Oprah's their hero, but I'm really like, but she's really, you don't understand. We've got a personal connection. And one of the most amazing things that Edward did was I told him, we were having a chat about something or the other. And I told him, like, she is my absolute ultimate. Like, everything she's achieved, you know, the odds that she's defied, it's not just who she is now, it's the journey of who she was. You know, you talk about outliers. She was on primetime TV with the most popular show in the 80s when she, her look, her size, you know, her ethnicity did not fit any of the demographics that were absolutely tried and tested. And somehow she managed to get herself in that position through really hard work and absolutely smash it and endure for 40 years. Like, for me, that is gold. Like, defying odds is absolutely gold. And so I just love everything about it. But anyway, I kind of had this conversation with Edward. We were talking about something else. He'd mentioned, you know, like casually, like, oh, he's going to call Oprah. And I was like, excuse me, what?
And I'll just WhatsApp Oprah.
And I was sort of like, oh, she's kind of my... And he was like, oh, you know, we should do dinner with Oprah at some point. I was like... Yeah, that would be nice.
Stop it, Vanessa.
You're like this
inside squeal, you know. And I was like, really just like...
And did you?
Do not throw him off by being too...
Fangirl.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, sure. I mean, if we can make it happen, it'd be kind of cool.
I'm kind of free always.
I know, yeah. Just like cancel everything. And just remember, he called me from New York and was just like, do you still want to do that thing with Oprah? And I was literally like, what thing? And he's like, you know, like a dinner or something. And I was like, yes. And he's like, okay, cool, we're going to do it this Sunday. Do you mind organizing it? And I'm like, it's Thursday. What are we going to do? So he's like, we're just going to do like a afternoon tea with her and so on. And he was like, because you said you really, and it would be cool to, she's coming to London. So then I was like, okay, cool. Put down the phone and was like, ah, you know, like, this is the woman you want to impress the most. And I've got 2 days. Also, Sunday happened to be Mother's Day. So it was like, just get together like 25 to 30 people, a great venue, and I'll see you on Sunday. And I was just like, who is going to come when they obviously will have plans with their mum?
Right.
Where am I going to get this amazing venue? You've seen the parties she throws and all the flowers, and she gives like Cartier gifts to everyone. But it was absolutely incredible because like everyone I spoke to were just like, my mum will understand, I'll be there. I will be there. And it was just the most amazing moment. I met her and she was really, you know, they say don't meet your heroes. Mm-hmm. Literally everything you'd want from her, because one of the things that I love from her, as we were saying earlier, is she is who she is, who she is. Mm-hmm. Like, there is no circumstance. I don't think she will surprise anyone. She's strong, opinionated, funny, charming, and it was just an absolute joy. Like, I felt anointed to have met her.
Yeah.
And then my grandmother and my mother were amazing role models to me growing up. I spent a lot of time with my grandmother when I was younger, and she's just still absolutely a guiding light, another woman who defied all sorts of odds. My grandmother left school at 14, despite her passion being English literature, and was just the most prolific reader. But her circumstances meant she couldn't continue with her education, and she had to start working at 14. She was a cotton picker. And that is, if you don't know it, a really excruciating, damaging job. You know, you're bent over all day. Cotton is basically prickles. And she would work these excruciating days and then self-teach and travel. She always wanted to travel but never did until she was in her 60s, and we brought her to England and took her around and so on. But she would travel in her mind by just reading. Mm. And she taught me so much. You know, when I came to England when I was 7 years old, I knew what it would look like because my grandmother told me. She'd never been here, but she'd read so much. She could describe to me, you know, how things would look and how it would feel. And she was somebody who always wanted her children and her grandchildren to live out their dreams, whatever those looked like, because she didn't get to live hers herself. And she was really unselfish. And she always used to say to me, every generation must do better than the last. And my job is to give you that platform and then you have to do the rest. And so I have this kind of, you know, feeling and a sense of responsibility to kind of deliver on her hard work, but also just live really authentically and live well. I never, ever remember her complaining. I never, you know, she literally had the best belly laugh and made like the best times of every situation. You know, she was just always a prankster and always having a good time. And, you know, when I look back at someone like that who objectively had a lot to complain about, I sort of just found the joy in stuff around her. It's really like a guiding light, you know. So I try not to focus too much on anything going wrong and focus on, you know, what's good here and how can I build that up. And I really think that came from her. So, yeah.
Do you know the sex of your baby?
I don't. I don't. But literally, old ladies keep coming up to me in the street like, when is he due?
Oh, okay.
Like, no one thinks I'm having a girl. Like, every single person. It's also just really weird being pregnant because it's like a welcome sign to everyone else. Like, people you don't know come up and stroke your stomach. I know people say it's really,
really
annoying.
Strange.
It's kind of really nice, though. I don't know. I feel like I should be offended, but I'm like, I'll go on, you know. Unless they're creepy. But yeah, everybody thinks I'm having a boy.
Okay. And I think it's a girl.
Yay, you're the only one.
I was about to say, what's the one thing that you'd love for your little girl to grow up? for your little human
little baby.
To grow up installed in them? What's the one thing you want to subscribe them with?
That exactly what my grandmother told me, that every generation must do better than the last. And that doing better is not necessarily about career success or anything like that. It's about living better. It's about, you know, I think, I hope that I can inspire this, you know, little human, whatever it is, a boy or a girl, to kind of, to just live well and go on to inspire people and be kind of happy and respectful of the people around, you know, him or her.
JD, you've said this as well, you know, who inspires them the most or who motivates them to do better. It always comes back to figureheads that represent an attitude, a mindset or a philosophy. It's never someone that's a multimillionaire or the CEO of this company or, you know, someone that championed this amazing movement. It's always family or someone that kind of deep-rootedly represents a mindset that inspires you, and everyone comes back to it, and yet we're also clouded with these desires to be better and more successful and earn more money, when really we should be developing our attitudes and values and morals, because that's actually what's inspiring us to be better.
I think that's just so eloquently put, because especially if you look at kind of what's going on in geopolitics at the moment, we have so many global challenges politically and, you know, more broadly with big business and so on. And so it's a real wake-up call, you know, to think about what's important. And I think the sort of, you know, 80s pursuit of kind of more wealth, we're seeing the products of that now. And it's like, well, turns out it hasn't really made us a kind of better globally, hasn't made us rich, you know. Our superpowers are all economically struggling, so where is that wealth gone? You know, our environment is struggling, people are struggling more, or certainly much more open about struggling with mental health and personal challenges. So it's kind of like, okay, we need to rewrite the script here. Like, that hasn't worked, and our aspirations can be about, you know, career success and those sorts of things. But my God, if you don't have something else that you're aspiring to, you're lost, man. I really feel like that. I'm very much each to your own person. But the one thing, one of the things I feel really strongly about is that we have to aspire to more than just wealth or career success. So success takes all kinds of forms.
I think also
I wanted to touch on this earlier. You kind of mentioned it, but, you know, we've talked a lot about being a senior woman in business and how important that is to raise awareness and expose the kind of potential of that to other young women.
Yeah.
And, you know, we haven't really heralded enough, but being the first woman ever, by the way, in Vogue's history to be publishing director is the magnitude of that and the effect that that has, kind of the ripple effect that will have on other women and their kind of the way they see themselves and their ability is, you know, immeasurable. And, you know, Jada and I, and Jada did this when, you know, she ran the marathon in her underwear.
It was amazing.
We're huge advocates of women just doing new things that have never been done before.
Being visible.
Because unless you make that first move to take that position or you run the marathon in your underwear, you know, other women aren't going to challenge themselves to jump into new opportunities.
I think, and it comes with this sort of slightly scary expectation. I didn't really know it until after I got the job. And I sometimes ask myself, like, would you have sort of bowed out if you knew? Because it's been amazing, like, how many women and sort of young women have reached out to me on that point, you know, of like, please come and speak at our student union or come and speak at our organization and so on, because, you know, it's really important to inspire these other women to go to leadership roles that are have not been occupied by women before and aspire to them. And at the beginning, I really had to say, I need to deliver in the job first before I can talk about how great, you know, it is. But I do feel so supremely supported. And one of the things I really think is really important is we're constantly hearing this narrative about, you know, women in business being really bitchy and and throwing down the ladder and all of this. I've honestly never had more support than in this role. So many people reached out to me, people I did not know, people I really admired, and, you know, were just like, we're so proud of you and if you need any help. And I was just like, I mean, on the one hand, it's absolutely incredible. On the other hand, it's like extra pressure because now they know I exist.
Now I really am.
And even, you know, going back to the Oprah thing, meeting her, it was one of the things that she said, like, this is incredible. And I was like, oh, wow, you know. But then there's this responsibility with that, isn't there, where you just kind of feel like I have to do my absolute, my utmost to nail this and to show that this can be done. And, you know, being honest, there were a lot of doubters. You know, the sort of triple challenge, as it's seen externally, of being, you know, yes, the first woman in the role, which no one would openly and outwardly admit was a challenge for them. But clearly it's been 102 years and it's not been any, you know, being the youngest person in the role in the company now. And, you know, youth is really... I mean, that's debatable, but being the youngest is authority and being perceived as young don't necessarily go together. And definitely I think being a woman of color and the first woman of color in the role, it means that you create a challenging paradigm for people because you don't look like what leadership usually looks like. And even people who are really open-minded just are challenged by it because it just feels like this is really different. And, you know, and so there were people who definitely doubted me, and I could see it in their questioning, double questioning of decisions. You know, I really had to work really hard to earn the trust and respect of certain people, and I'm still working on it now. But it's kind of just part of it, you know. You just, it's not, I'm not going to say that there weren't days where I woke up in that first year just thinking, oh my God, this is literally like too much.
You mentioned being out of your depth or feeling out of your depth, and I really believe that everybody is out of their depth until they learn to swim in that depth. And I think it's like we're expected to be
just brilliant as soon as we start. And that's A, not realistic, and B, it's not really attainable, because you're going to get good at the job once you start doing the job, and you need time, and people need to respect, they need to be patient around that to give you the space to deliver.
Definitely.
I think that that's not always a given, though. Sometimes you just have to create it. You know, my challenge was that, you know, what I really wanted was sort of 6 months to grow into the role and get up to speed and learn what had gone on. And that just wasn't afforded me because of the situation. It was from day one, these are massively hiked up targets that you've got to hit. And, you know, lots and lots of challenges around restructuring, which I was set with. And it was really sort of like, I need a minute. And also I need people to get on board. I need to take the time to get. And that was not something that was there. So I think the other thing is, you know, one of the most brilliant bits of advice that I was given was, and this is going to sound really counterintuitive when I was much younger, is expecting to arrive and everything be fair is the fastest way to madness. You know, if you expect to turn up in every situation and things to be laid out fairly for you, you're going to be disappointed a lot of the times, you know, particularly if you are a challenger in any way. You know, if you're challenging the status quo, a lot of the times it's our roles to make things fair or fairer than when we arrived. And it's really difficult, but it's kind of part of the process of doing anything new and doing, you know.
That's a great point.
Yeah,
I completely agree. And I think it's just the paradigm and like the narrative that we've been taught, and I think what we're doing with the podcast and all of our incredible guests that we have on, and the thing that they have in common is that they are all trailblazers in their career, in their space that they're occupying at the moment. Well, one of the most watched TED Talks, all about feminism, I think it's called Why We Should Be a Feminist, talks about situations where, for example, you're at a dinner, maybe the CEO is a woman, she's there with her colleague who's a man, and the check gets passed to him. And it's these things that are ingrained into us, so you're going to turn up because that's just the way the system's set up at the moment. But it's examples that you're creating that are then slowly going to shift that norm and recreate a different narrative going forward. And off the back of that, what would you say is the biggest misconception people may have about you?
Oh my God. I mean, this is really interesting because it's something I'm exploring a lot right now, because I think I have a work persona, you know, and if you work closely with me, you know what I'm like, and then a sort of private persona. And one of the things I definitely think has been progressing in me is actually merging the two, like the concept of being more stoic and somehow different at work, you know.
How do you do that?
It's actually really difficult when you're in, there's so many sort of oxymorons in the position that, you know, I've just described to you, whereby you don't look like a classic authority figure. And unless you act like it, people will not let you fill that space. It's really important to, you know, that whole thing, like dress for the job you want. You have to act in the way that you want people to receive you. And when you're in the space of kind of setting that, you know, dynamic, you have to keep a little bit back. You can't be sort of skipping in and telling people about the, you know, what happened last night and what you did on the weekend, because it's you know, I struggled with the fact that I was basically promoted from within my team. You know, I've been at this company for 10 years, and certainly at GQ, I was kind of one of the team, literally one day, and the following morning, I was in the big office, and it's like, you know, so you have to kind of pull back a little bit. But I think once that kind of new position's been set, it's really important for people to see you as human. And I mean, you touched on something really interesting earlier about something like being pregnant, is suddenly people have sort of looked at you as the boss and the person who makes difficult decisions and the person who's, you know, pushing really hard, to like, oh God, that person's human, you know? So I think one of the, you know, traits, this is playing to stereotypes slightly, but I think one of the feminine traits, or classically seen as feminine traits, that I really believe in is empathy. And I think really that's been the thing that's been most binding for me and the people I work with. Like, I expect a lot from the people working with me, but also I really spend a lot of time putting myself in people's shoes, particularly with the things that are going on with them personally. And where people are having challenges, I might sort of choose to take them aside and share a little bit if I have an experience that's similar, or definitely kind of make room for them to kind of live that experience by giving more time off or more support or more training or whatever I think is going to help with that. And even if they're not nailing it on a work front, it's just, I think it's really important to just try our best all of the time to see things from someone else's point of view and from their experience, and it creates a much better working relationship.
I also think, you know, there isn't a disconnect between people's ability to deliver good work and how they're feeling emotionally and mentally. And if you make time for your employees and you pay an interest in the personal things in their life that make them happy and stimulate them and trigger them to feel good, you know, it's proven over and over that the happier and healthier your employees, the better the output of their work. So this idea that you shouldn't get too close because it undermines the kind of way that things should be or set up for good work has been proven incorrect.
Yeah, exactly.
So I do think, I had an experience recently where I bumped into an ex-boyfriend of mine that wasn't very nice to me, and I was in such shock when it happened, and I walked to the office and I was in tears, and I was like, I can either go home and tell them that I'm not feeling well, or I can go up and they can see me in this situation. And I decided to go up because I thought it was really important to show the team at that point that there's real power in vulnerability, and show them that, like, things also affect me too, and I'm going to continue working through, but this was a painful moment. And I think it is, you know, and you're clearly like this, it's important for senior leaders to show that you can be really good at your job and also feel really sad because something happens in your personal life.
I think it's kind of vital, right? Because if you're asking people to work differently and it feels like a lot, you can start to feel perhaps kind of a bit detached, and, you know, so that kind of humanizing is really important. And it's also kind of amazing to see the support network you have as well. You know, it's like, it's kind of mutually beneficial, I think, as well.
And maybe as a leader, you don't often let people show up for you. Not that you need your employees to do that, but just to have that human interaction again. I just came to mind, but I guess when you're pregnant, it softens you in a sense because, you know, your defense is down a little bit because you're vulnerable. So I think that could be the reason why people, why people are more attracted to you. But I think, like you said, with the whole empathy thing being a feminist trait, biologically we are built to be more alert to, you know, when we have children and the needs, and meet their needs empathically and in other ways too. But I think as a leader, that, and being a woman in leadership, that is a huge advantage. And not only being that quite stoic or that strong pillar of strength that leadership can often have, and taking on the burden of looking after other people and being responsible, having the empathy is just going to give you the edge. And I think more women in power.
I mean, I really agree with that so strongly. It's so interesting, I think, because in previous decades, you know, I slightly call it sort of the Maggie Thatcher format, you know, we were women in leadership or aspiring to leadership were kind of, you know, almost taught that the way to do it was to kind of emulate masculine traits or, you know, and, you know, whenever I'm doing sort of my mentoring sessions or, you know, doing any of my talks or anything, I always say to the women in attendance, like, you can never be a better man than a man. Like, that's aspiring to something that you just cannot hit, you know. The best way to succeed is to pull out the best traits that you already have. So it's no longer about suppressing the things that you think are feminine, you know, perhaps getting emotionally kind of invested in things that you're doing, or things like empathy. It's like, bring that to the front, actually. Mm-hmm. And your leadership skills will gel really well with your male counterparts' leadership skills. We don't need to have the same things replicated, you know.
Absolutely.
What we actually need is a mix of perspectives in leadership. So if you are someone who feels passionately about certain things, or you, you know, are great at kind of, you know, you worry about your staff and you worry about why someone's kind of been ill a few too many times, or they're just not looking themselves, that's great leadership. It's a different kind of leadership to what's taught, but it's kind of probably needed more now than ever.
I think the point you made about bringing your best traits to the forefront and letting them carry you through, and owning that combination of unique personality skills, I think it's super important. And was actually listening to a podcast today and talking about how that is how we should be viewing relationships as well.
Yeah.
Rather than looking for our other half or somebody to complete us, or to kind of like slot into, you know, for us to slot into their life. It's if we can bring those things forward, then somebody will meet you at your best.
Yeah.
And I think that was a quite a powerful way of viewing, you know, how this could be carried across all different forums.
I think it's really true. Like, in, you know, like, I've always been like really fascinated with those dating books. I have to be honest and say I've never read any of them, but just like the ethos of kind of, you know, the game and all of those things where it's like, you have to act this way and pretend this. And it's like, well, what's the point? When you end up with that person...
I also read The Game and didn't get any dates. So it didn't work for me.
Yeah. It's like, this person is going to kind of finally be like, this isn't what I signed up for, you know?
Yeah.
But also, it's so manufactured. It's like, don't look at him in the eye, and when he offers to buy you a drink, don't...
Every man is so different.
I'm confused. It's like, but I want the drink.
Yeah, I want the drink. And also, he's got really nice eyes. It's like, I failed in the immediate instance.
Yeah, well, we love a game. Maybe not the game, but we do love a game. We love to bring our guests a gift.
Okay.
And this is a food section, because I believe the best conversations happen around food. And so we bring something that we think kind of represents them, or how the relationship was formed and built. So do you want to go first?
No, you go first.
Okay. So I bought...
This is amazing.
You kind of saw this already, Vanessa, you little cheat. I should have actually hid it. I'm going to explain it.
Okay, good.
So for all of our listeners who I haven't explained already, me and Vanessa met a couple of years back now, when I was lucky enough to be invited on a lovely retreat with Lululemon, and we was taken to a place called OC Island, which sounds super exotic, but it was actually just off the coast of England. And but because we met on OC Island, I thought I'd bring you some tropical fruits to reignite that feeling.
Yeah. This is better than mine, so brace yourself.
No, these are like...
But there were no palm trees.
There was nothing exotic about it there. It was cold, it was gloomy, but we had, you know, great activities filled with incredible people. But so I thought, to kind of reignite that, I've brought you some mangoes and passion fruit and a coconut water.
Okay, so you have no idea how poignant this is. So I am obsessed with mangoes. When I was little and lived in St. Kitts in the Caribbean, in mango season, I would eat them until I was sick, literally. And so now, if ever like any of my friends want to cheer me up, they literally scour around to get me mangoes. My mother just is visiting from St. Kitts and found me a mango out of season. And my... pretend society name is Mango King Oral.
Oh my god!
Literally, like, you've nailed it.
Wow,
that
was amazing.
That was a good quick buy.
I haven't read any pregnancy books, but I started reading one which was gifted to me, which said, you know, to avoid like eating too many sugars and things like that, which immediately I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to discount this. But the one thing it said, you know, keep fruit to a minimum, particularly mangoes. I'm like, no. Who would single out a mango?
No.
I was just like,
poor mango.
Book put down, never let it again.
Hell no, disregard that book and eat the mangoes.
Definitely.
Amazing.
Thank you.
That. Well, I sadly didn't have the luxury of meeting you before today. But I read a lot about you and you're incredibly inspirational to me. I love a pun. Yeah, so mine's supposed to be funny, but it's okay if you don't laugh. The first one
I mean, I always crack up at these.
Some dill.
Okay.
Because the number of accolades
where is this going?
The number of accolades that you have against your name is tremendous and incredibly inspirational. And I think you're a really big dill. I hate myself.
Amazing.
But like the name of this particular dill is quite interesting.
I don't
also
yeah.
look. It's dillweed.
It's from Whole
Are
Foods.
You sure that...
It's from my mate round the corner. No, I'm kidding. It's from Whole Foods.
It's from Whole
That's
Foods.
For after
I think
the
it's
show.
Legit, but maybe wait until you've given birth till you do that. And then the second is a pack of raisins because you are a prime example of an incredible trailblazer, pioneer, and female who is raising the bar.
Amazing.
I wouldn't eat all of those at once.
Oh, that's so sweet. Aww. Thanks. I have to give these back now.
No, they're,
no,
all
they're yours.
Look what a beautiful meal you can make. With
I know,
of this.
Very healthy. That's so sweet. Thank you.
And that was the lovely Vanessa Kingori. Thank you all for tuning in to Unsubscribe.
And if you like what you heard today or have any thoughts on the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. So make sure to both rate the episode and add a comment now.
And stay tuned for next week's special guest.
Unsubscribe is powered by Fourth Floor Creative and brought to you by Bumble, the social network where it's never too late to make the first move.